You want money, right? You want someone to write you a check, not the other way around. You want someone from your billing department to come to you and say, hey, why did we receive this check? Well, if you work with CPower Energy Management, that's what's going to happen. CPower provides demand-side energy management solutions that help keep you green and earn revenue in the process. CPower is a leading national provider of demand-side energy management solutions that pay you for reducing load on the energy grid. Find out more about CPower's demand-side energy management solutions at CPowerEnergyManagement.com. From Green Tech Media, this is The Energy Gang, a weekly digest on energy, clean tech, and the environment. I'm Stephen Lacey. Welcome. This week, we've got not one, not two, but three revolutions to talk about: vehicle autonomy, vehicle sharing, and vehicle electrification. Dr. Dan Sperling is a transportation expert at UC Davis, and he's out with a new book called Three Revolutions. He'll be on the show to talk about whether those revolutions will reinvent or ruin the way we get around. Then, over to the realignment of global energy giants. We'll run through some of the most recent strategy shifts at the world's top energy companies as they try to get their arms around the clean energy, customer-focused transition. Now let's all open our arms for Mr. Jigar Shah, who's been out the last few weeks. He's back in Maryland from India. Welcome home, sir.
Thanks. My lungs appreciate it.
You were in a blackout. I didn't hear from you for weeks. If not for the interview you did at the What It Takes series last week in Oakland, I would have thought you were avoiding us.
I did really try to do a social media and all things computer blackout.
Well, our listeners were a little bit worried about you as well. We got some emails from folks who were concerned, but have no fear, dear listeners. Catherine Hamilton is here with us as well, per usual. She's a partner with 38 North Solutions right there in Washington, D.C. Hello, Catherine.
Hi, it's good to have the gang back.
It is indeed. So the topic at hand today: how to steer automated shared electric vehicles to a better future. I am continually astounded by the moment that we live in. You know, we're sitting right in the middle of so many concurrent revolutions in energy, tech, communications, you name it. And although they're moving really fast, it's never been easier to kind of step back and collectively reflect on their consequences. And that's what our guest, Dan Sperling, is doing in transportation. His new book, co-authored with a bunch of other experts, is called Three Revolutions, and it explores the consequences of the monumental change we're now facing in how we get around. Dr. Sperling is a distinguished professor of civil engineering and environmental science and policy at the University of California, Davis. Professor Sperling, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to join you.
So we throw around the term revolution a lot. Sometimes it's warranted, sometimes it's not. But you argue in this book that transport is facing three revolutions. Again, autonomy, sharing, and electrification. Why do you believe that this is a revolution?
Okay, I might have overstated a little bit. But the automation part of it is the one that truly can be and likely will be revolutionary, transformational. Electric vehicles is part of it. I think there's going to be a more steady progression of it. The industry, I think, will adapt to it and invest in it, and it won't be too disruptive. And pooling, sharing has its implications and impacts, but are not those two, each of them by themselves would not be transformational. But together with automated vehicles, it will be revolutionary. It will change our lifestyles. It'll change the automobile industry. It'll change land use in cities. It'll change energy. So it will really have a big impact.
Well, we're going to try to go through each of those, or as many of those as we can. First, go back for me to 1991, when you founded the Institute for Transportation Studies. What did you consider the future of transportation to be then?
Well, I'll go back even further. So I've been working in this field for a few decades now in transportation, and frankly, it's been boring. There's been very little innovation for decade after decade in transportation. I mean, you might even say the interstate highway system and limited access freeways back in the 50s was perhaps the last innovation, or you could even go back earlier than that. So I've been thinking about and preaching about how do we create a more sustainable transportation system? But the focus used to be much more so just on the fuels, electric vehicles, efficient vehicles. And the hope of really changing our cities or how we get about, we couldn't even imagine that. And it wasn't really until maybe the late 90s. I had a graduate student, Susan Shaheen, who's played a very big role in this space. And together we started talking about what is this new mobility future. And there was not much before that. So it's really stunning that all of a sudden, after all these years of so little innovation in the transportation sector, and in passenger transportation especially, all of a sudden we're seeing these dramatic changes. And some of them are not quite here yet. It's more like we're on the cusp of these changes.
All right, well then, let's go through a couple scenarios for the future of transportation, given this new set of technologies we're dealing with. We kind of did this back in January of 2017. We talked with Josh Goldman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who we talked about autonomous vehicles specifically. But now we're increasing the complexity and layering, sharing, electrification on top. So let's talk about the dream scenario and the nightmare scenario for this three-part revolution. What is your dream future for when these technologies do come together? Is there a specific vision that you can paint for us?
Well, there's been tremendous hype on the automated vehicles. And by the way, I say automated, not autonomous, because these vehicles will not be autonomous. That's a poor use of the English language. But it was introduced by Google in 2010 when they had their small little automated car, and they called it an autonomous car. It was really that Silicon Valley hubris that they could just do whatever they want. It was going to be autonomous and the world will adjust to it. And these cars of the future will be connected. They'll be connected to the infrastructure. They'll be connected to other vehicles. They will not be operating autonomously in any way. So the vision going forward is that if these automated vehicles are connected up with pooling, in other words, that the vehicles are not individually owned, but are owned by mobility service companies, what is technically called mobility as a service. So they're mobility service companies. They carry multiple people in the vehicle. They're sharing of the vehicle in the true sense of it. And they're electrified, which would bring their emissions and energy use down considerably. It's that marriage of those three that makes it very hopeful future, a very positive, what we call the heaven scenario sometimes, or the utopian scenario.
I think what's really crucial that you point out in the book, and that I've seen you point out in other interviews, that pooled services really are the key. Getting policymakers and mobility providers to think about how you get more bodies in every vehicle. And, you actually walk through the history of shared transport, which was a big thing, a few decades ago, and it kind of fizzled out. So I'd love for you to talk about why pooled transport is so vital to this vision and how it's evolved over time.
Yeah, it's not evolved in a good way.
right.
20 years ago, the average carpooling accounted for about 20% of all commute trips. Now it's down under 10%. And that's at a time where we built this whole network of carpool lanes, HOV lanes, spent billions and billions of dollars, put a lot of effort into it, and the result was a shrinking market share. So it's been the carpool lane and the ride sharing has been largely a failure over the last few decades. And that's what we're up against. So the question is, why will this future be different than the past?
Yeah, so I, back in 2009, I had a lot of chances to meet up with Larry Burns, who I think was the first guy that ran Google's self-driving cars unit. He was the former head of R&D for GM. And
Larry was a consultant to Google. He never worked for Google as an employee.
But he described this whole thing to me around basically on a cost per mile basis that, all three of these revolutions together could get you to sort of 90 to 95% cheaper cost per mile than where you were today. But I remember the conversation was always very individualistic, right? It was always, you know, in your book, you guys have this table where you say the fork in the road, and you basically have, you know, what the, you know, good outcome would be and what the bad outcome might be. And, you know, I mean, I think his vision for it, while he painted it positively, was sort of more bad outcome, right? Where like people like myself, I mean, I was just in San Francisco where I think I took 7 Lyft rides in 3 days, and I was by myself in every one of those 7 trips. And it probably cost me more than if I had rented a car actually for 3 days, but it was more convenient just to take Lyft. And so, I mean, that does feel like we're on track to the bad outcome and not the good outcome.
Well, if you look at history and you think about human behavior, there's very good reason why you would be skeptical about this pooling. But going back to what Larry Burns was saying, that there's 2 pieces here. What Larry was emphasizing in those days is that if you had an automated car, then your time was freed up in that vehicle. So now in transportation, we value people's time and we're making decisions about whether to invest in a new building, a new road, and so on. We say, you know, it's $15 an hour on average or something like that. For many people that own cars, it's much higher. So if all of a sudden you free up $20 or $30 an hour, and you can use it for other purposes, then of course you're going to buy an automated car. But by the way, you're also going to use that automated car a lot more because now there is not that time cost associated with it. So it can be a hotel room, it can be an office, it can be use it for entertainment, watching movies, you can text, sleep. So if you just play this out, the kind of most likely scenario would be that people that buy cars now will pay a little bit more for their automated car and end up driving it a lot more, or it driving itself a lot more. And it's not only more vehicle miles with a person in it, but you're going to have a lot of empty vehicle miles, what we call zero occupant vehicle miles.
And right, because you would buy a cheaper house 100 miles away, live on a farm, and then commute to work 2 hours each way because, you know, you can't.
And exactly. And you wouldn't bother paying the high parking fee in the city or where you are. And you just send the car, you know, back home or just circling around somewhere. You go to a meeting. You're not sure exactly when you're going to get out. You just have that car circling around the building until you're ready for it. So you can just imagine that the amount of vehicle miles would just increase dramatically.
So if that's the likely outcome, like I've been brainstorming with my colleagues around, you know, how you could potentially avoid it. One of the things for me is what's shocking to me is in San Francisco, for instance, but I think DC is the same. I cannot use pre-tax transit dollars for Lyft, Line, or Uber pool because they don't have a minimum of 8 seats. And so isn't this just maybe more policy?
It's going to be all about policy because car companies are going to want to sell cars that are at a premium, automated, and they have no reason to want to sell it to a mobility service company. They'd just as soon sell it to an individual. People are going to buy it. So if we're going to change this future, it is going to require a lot of policy. And frankly, we're screwing up with policy already because policy is lagging. And it's not, I mean, that's not really a criticism of policy. It's these innovations and changes are happening so quickly that it's very hard for government and policymakers to keep up.
So I wanted to ask Dan about a specific policy, which was in DC, we have, you know, high occupancy vehicle lanes, and back when I was working for utility many decades ago, and honestly, a lot of people lived out in the suburbs because that's where you could buy affordable housing, and then you would have to carpool, and you were required because they hadn't built all these big express lanes. You really had to have 4 people in every car to use this one special lane, and that was the only way you could get to work without it taking an hour and a half each way. And so I was in a carpool that had, because you had to have 5 people in case one person's sick, that was a stripped down Astro minivan with a bunch of beanbag chairs and beach chairs in the back. And that's how we rode to work every day in suits. So anyway, just picture that in your brain. And that was how in, you know, before they started building these big express lanes, you would do it. You would pile into the car. It was the only way to do it, to get to work on in a, any kind of timely way and to save money. Now what they've done is they have these high occupancy vehicle lanes and they will charge you extra pricing. So you can be charged up to $45 if you're not registered as a pooling type of car, which is, I think, a huge incentive. So it allows people, and I think this is what is going to be critical, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about policies in this. It's choice. So you can choose to drive by yourself and pay a lot of money, or you can choose to pool and save a lot of money, but it gives the passengers choice. And I feel like with all these consumer-based technologies and apps, that choice is going to be really important in any policy you determine.
You've just nailed it. That's exactly right. The problem with pricing is people are, they don't like it, right? It feels like they're being punished because they don't have any choice. That's how they perceive it. So the first step here going forward is creating choice. And that is why I'm a big champion of these Lyft line services, Uber Pool, the micro transit companies such as Via, because they're creating choice. And in some cases, it's just maybe just the perception of choice. In some cases, it is the reality of choice. But once you have choice, then you can start adopting these incentives and disincentives. And so just an example of how it can be. So that example with the carpool lanes, the HOV lanes, is a good one. Another one, even more closer to what we're talking about, is recently Chicago just imposed much higher fees on the what we call the TNCs, Lyft, Uber, Via. And they did it per ride. And so they took away any incentive for these pooling services because you just pay, you know, if you have three people in the car, you just pay three times, you know, the fee is paid three times. It should be that there's a discount for it, just like in that carpool lane. And the same thing is happening at the airports with the TNCs, is that there's no incentive being used to encourage the pooling. And that's really just a very first initial step, but it's illustrative, indicative of the challenge we're going to have in changing policy, because in changing finance and policy in transportation.
But I get the whole thing around choice because, you know, it's kind of cool. But why not actually go the route of mandates? I mean, it's certainly how we succeeded in the renewable energy industry. I don't think choice was what drove the renewable electricity industry. It was really mandates around, you know, like for instance, in DC, if you want a new taxi cab medallion, it has to be an electric vehicle. That's just the mandate. Right. And so a lot of people have bought electric vehicles for their new taxi cabs because they couldn't get a taxi cab medallion otherwise. It just seems like the cities could mandate that Lyfts and Ubers now have to be electric vehicles or plug-in hybrids, or else they can't, you know, operate.
It's tempting. You know, I have what I call my moonlighting job. I'm a regulator. I hold a board seat. Actually, it's the transportation board seat on the California Air Resources Board. And in that role, we are adopting all kinds of rules dealing with electric vehicles, electric trucks, and a lot more. And what I've seen is it is tempting. So there are some cases where the challenges of just using these more sophisticated, nuanced policies of pricing and even performance-based approaches, they just don't get it done very quickly or very timely way. So if we feel urgency, then there is a role. But when you do these mandates, I just have to say, everyone, you know, every Dick and Jane company and individual comes up and has a special case why they need to be accommodated. You know, they're big families, or they need the gasoline car for some reason, or they have no place to charge. You know, they come up with all kinds of stories, and you end up creating these rules that just are filled with loopholes, and it's hard for a regulator to resist it. So using these more performance-based, market-based approaches is better policy, generally speaking.
I have a couple more policy questions for you, Dan. One of which is, so NHTSA, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, put forward guidance on AVs, and it's voluntary. It's called A Vision for Safety. And it was trying to create regulation, I believe, that would be more flexible and allow for technology to move ahead and not be so set in stone that would actually hold technology back, but that would provide some room to move. How do you think that's going? On the federal side, do you think that's enough, or do you think we need more?
Actually, Congress is stepping in, and they've been debating adopting much more aggressive rules on it, but with a lot of flexibility. And the car companies like it because it does allow more innovation. There's been a lot of opposition to it, and I'm a little sympathetic to that opposition in this particular case. And it's really in the best interest of these companies and these cars. And that is because actually it was the former director of NHTSA gave a talk at a conference I ran last week, David Friedman. And he pointed out that with safety and vehicles, and when you have companies involved, he says, think of the General Motors ignition problem of a few years ago. There was just a tiny, tiny little problem really with the ignition. It did kill a few people, about 10 or 12 people over a period of 10 years. And we invested so much effort into it. There were lawsuits. GM lost a lot of money. It was paid penalties and lawsuits. The airbag problem recently, same kind of storyline. And yet, look at airlines. Look how much money and effort we put into it. The difference, the consistent story in both of those cases is when companies are responsible, we impose a very high level of scrutiny on it. I mean, think about us in driving our cars. We have 30,000 deaths per year compared to those 10 connected with General Motors. 37,000. And we resist rules on rules on texting, on drinking, because it's us as individuals. But when a corporation's involved, we impose a much higher level of scrutiny. And so when we get to these automated cars, if we don't have a really well-established process for liability and responsibility and so on, the first time there's an accident or a problem, it's going to shut down that whole industry and that technology. So I think it's in the interest of the companies as well as the technology, as well as innovation, to really work through a lot of these rules and standards and so on before we let those vehicles out in any kind of major way.
And would some of those rules and standards also include cybersecurity and privacy and protection from hacking?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's going to be, those questions are going to come up almost immediately. And I'll say on the safety part of it. So, my wife has a Tesla and she got the autopilot in it just to make me happy as I could have it for my professional experimentation. And it scares the hell out of her. And I, frankly, myself too, the technology still has quite a ways to go. The cars get confused if the lanes have been restriped or there's construction going on there. And yeah, they're making tremendous advances on it, but there's so many things that can go wrong that there is a lot of hype here. I think it's going to be a while before we have really fully automated cars. And in a sense, that's good. It gives us a little breather time to figure out these policies on pooling and how do we make this transition to this heaven scenario in a more effective and timely way.
Dan, I really played up the revolutions in the beginning of the piece. Now you're making me feel like I hyped it up a little bit too much.
Well, it is going to be transformational when it happens. And it is going to happen because automated control of vehicles, automated vehicles is so compelling. In so many ways, in safety, I mean, heck, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny of these cars and this technology, but the reality is almost immediately they're going to be much safer than us. It's really more a question of liability and insurance and lawsuits and things like that, rather than actual improvements in safety and then all the other good things that will follow.
So when you think about the renewable electricity industry, you know, the utility companies have been largely intractable in terms of, you know, sort of innovation. And when you think about this space, it feels like the transit agencies are the same in terms of their intractability, right? And like, for instance, like, you know, like I have a bunch of unused money on my smart card from DC's, you know, transit agency, but I can't use it for all this innovation. On top of that, the app that I have on my phone doesn't integrate Via or Lyft or Uber into my transit experience. So if I just said, I'd like to go to this place, like I don't have an app that says, okay, well, here's how we're going to get you there and we'll use your transit dollars to get there if you do pooling and share and whatever, right? It just feels like there's a permission needed from the transit agencies to really make this work for the middle class and the, you know, the rest of us.
Yeah, transit's in big, big trouble in this country. They're almost, I think, something like 36 out of the 40 largest metropolitan areas lost transit ridership in the last few years. And so almost across the board, they're losing share, you know, as the economy, in part, there's a lot of explanations for it. But one of the explanations here, they are losing a little bit to Lyft and Uber. That's not the major cause, but that's one piece of it. The problem is that we've starved transit for so long in this country, and they've atrophied. They don't have much capability. They don't have many resources. They're heavily subsidized, and they just don't have the human resources or the financial resources to be really innovative. And here we are asking them to really to adjust, to incorporate all of these new innovations, and they're just not prepared to do it. And yet they have to, because to survive, just as you're talking about, they need to collaborate, partner with these new types of services. They need to either collaborate with them or incorporate them directly themselves. Ideally, we'd have one app, you know, for a metropolitan area, and all the financial transactions would go through it, all the information, you just press the button, and it would tell you what to do and where, and it would pay for it. But in the U.S., it's really hard to imagine how that's going to happen. It could happen in Europe. You know, their transit agencies are in better financial shape, and they have, you know, they're stronger as organizations. But it's going to be a big issue. But yet, transit is so critical. I mean, it's critical for two reasons. One is, in an economic sense, it's the best way to move large numbers of people from one place to another by far. And the other is, it provides that safety net for a lot of the disadvantaged parts of our society. So we need to figure out how to make it happen. But it's really worrisome how that's going to play out.
But what are the, I just, you know, like reading your book, I was just so inspired by the, you know, the opportunity we have in front of us. But I think from your last comment, it feels like you're not hopeful around the best outcome occurring, right? Because in the policy recommendations that you make, I mean, transit and then land use are critical pieces of it, right? And neither one of those can really be solved by just, you know, innovators and entrepreneurs. I mean, they really do need to be solved by heavy government policy involvement.
Yeah, you know, a little bit I'm trying to scare people into taking action, I confess. I am optimistic because here's why I'm optimistic. You know, the transit part of it, I am a little worried about how we're going to figure that out. But I'm optimistic the whole thing will end up playing well, because at the end of the day, that I think people will prefer to be chauffeured. So if they're rich enough, they can have their own car. But, you know, a lot of people won't be in that circumstance. So there's going to be a lot of demand for these mobility service companies, because it's going to be so cheap to travel. In fact, some of the companies like Google and Silicon Valley companies are already thinking that it's so cheap that they can sell, they can pay, they'll subsidize trips for these where you have multiple people in a car, because they can say, okay, if you're willing to stop at a Starbucks, then we'll pay for your trip. Or if you're willing to make a restaurant reservation, we'll pay for your trip, because the cost of that trip is so little and the advertising benefit would be so great. So I think out of that, that there will be people that will value the chauffeuring as we create more choice, that it'll be, people will be able and willing to give up a car, and then car sharing will become more more common, so that people can access like a pickup truck when they want it, or an SUV. So to have more, this is that theme of choice. It's what's more American than choice, right? So we have choice of having a low cost travel. We have access to different kinds of vehicles. And out of that, I think that'll create the political support to impose some of these policies that will support, you know, the better, the mobility as a service, the sharing of vehicles.
But do you really see the tech companies getting on board with that type of heavy regulation that we've been talking about? You know, these are companies, like, what is the responsibility of the tech companies themselves, the ones who are largely, you know, developing these services out of Silicon Valley? They're all about the techno-libertarian utopian vision. They're all about scale and selling as much hardware and software as possible. So, like, we're talking about kind of pigeonholing them into one scenario, and that doesn't stack up very well with the way these companies grow and see the world. So, like, I'm a bit pessimistic that the tech companies themselves are going to want to fit into this vision.
Well, the tech companies, they're going to play all kinds of different roles. What I think a different way of looking at it is, look at it from a car company perspective. So there's a quote in my book from Ford, John Vieira Ford. He says, when we look at our business, we have a return of maybe 5 to 10% in a good year. A service company has a return of 20 or 25%. He says, what do you think we're going to do internally? What is our decision process going to be? We're going to figure out how to run these services, these mobility services. And that is what we're doing. And that's what all the car companies are doing. Now, whether you can turn a Titanic so easily is uncertain in terms of these big car companies. But the car companies are all, they all have set up, you know, affiliates or divisions to pursue this. You were going to see a lot more entrepreneurs. You're going to have, you know, companies like Uber and Lyft and Via. They're all committed to the mobility as a service, to mobility service. So I think you're going to see a lot of money and a lot of entrepreneurship going in that direction, because there's a lot to be made. The car companies, you know, they're worried about the Silicon Valley companies just becoming, that they'll become like the IBM to the Microsoft, where, you know, the Silicon Valley companies will be making all the profit and they'll be stuck with a commodity vehicle. So this is a really uncertain future.
Well, Dan, I was at the CERAWeek last week, and the most inspiring speaker there by far was Mary Barra, the CEO of GM, who was completely on board with EVs and a different future of transportation. But one of the questions that I had for you was workforce related. And when we look at what happened and has been happening in clean energy, and we've created so many jobs in renewable energy, we probably haven't paid enough attention to the jobs that were lost in industries that are going out of business. Like, there are a lot of out of work coal miners and coal plant workers that we probably haven't been intentional enough about bringing them along into the cleaner energy future. So what I'm wondering from you is, this move toward more automated vehicles and in having a different kind of transportation system, there are going to be people who lose their jobs, who are drivers by trade, who do things that we will no longer need them to do. How do we bring them along and make sure that, you know, what kinds of jobs or new kind of jobs are going to be created that we will need to think about more intentionally?
That's a great and important question. I actually think this is one place where unequivocally it'll play out in a positive way. And that's because if you think about it now, only about 2% of our trips are what I'll call chauffeured trips. That means by bus or limousine or taxi or Lyft or Uber in this country. And what we're talking about here is increasing that 2% share up to 20, 40, 60, 80%. And so what that implies is now that other 98% of our travel is done by us as individuals. It's a private activity. It's uncompensated. So we're taking all of that uncompensated activity and turning it into a commercial activity. And so just by definition, just, you know, intuitively, we're going to generate a lot of jobs to launch and support those commercial services. So yes, there are going to be some people that lose jobs. You know, and the taxi drivers and some of the other drivers, but it's really going to be a very small number compared to how many new jobs are created. And yes, there's the transition, and we've learned, you know, we have to pay attention to that. But this new number of jobs is going to be, you know, could be very, very large. And it's all the people, it's going to be high quality jobs, all the people running these companies, the entrepreneurs, the accountants, the engineers, the programmers. But there's also the customer care people, the car care people. And so out of that, I think there are going to be a lot of jobs. And, you know, we do need to pay attention to it. I think it's on the freight side. We haven't talked about the freight side because it's a really more complicated. On the freight side, there is more of a question of this transition. We've got all these truck drivers, and how is that going to play out? And frankly, I don't have a good answer to that one.
So on a few times on this podcast over the last 2 years or so, we've asked various experts to envision what the car company of the future will look like. And it seems like a very good time to revisit that. So, Dan, I'd love for you to paint how this will impact the car companies themselves. Will the Silicon Valley ride-sharing companies, will they be part of large automakers? Or vice versa? How important is mobility going to be versus just selling a new car? Envision that future for us.
Yeah, so the future is almost certainly going to be somewhat fewer cars, but used much more intensively. So that means there'll be a lot, the turnover of the cars will be quicker. Although when they're electric, they'll last longer and they'll be more reliable and less maintenance. So that's one of the reasons why electrification of vehicles is a natural marriage with this automated future for the vehicles. The question becomes, so the vehicles, at least in the more socially hopeful future of these mobility service companies and the cars having multiple riders. These cars, one change is going to be the cars are going to become more passenger centric as opposed to driver centric. Now you build the cars for the driving experience. In the future, you'll design it for the passenger. So you don't want the high performance necessarily. You want more of a smoother ride and you want to be, you know, make the car, all the seats more comfortable. And for the ownership, it is a big question. Who's going to own and manage these cars? And as I said, the car companies would be worried that they lose control to others in terms of both the building of the cars as well as the management of these services. So I think likely the car companies, they're big, they're powerful, they've got a lot of resources. They'll adapt in some way, but I think there's a lot of space for more entrepreneurial companies to run the services. And there'll be some mix of that probably. But in the end, there's going to be these mobility service companies that play a huge role in our economy and our transportation system.
Well, however this plays out, it's going to happen and it's necessary. And I can speak personally. I'm one of these people. I'm a new car owner, haven't had a car in a long time, but my car basically just sits there and my cost per mile is astronomical. So hopefully by the time I'm out in the market for another car, I won't have to buy one and I'll just be able to rely on an automated electric shared vehicle for all my needs. Professor Dan Sperling is a distinguished professor of civil engineering and environmental science and policy at the University of California, Davis. He is the lead author of the new book, Three Revolutions, How to Steer Automated Shared Electric Vehicles to a Better Future. Dan, thank you so much.
And Steve, thank you, and Catherine and Jigar. It's been a wonderful experience, and thank you so much for bringing attention to this very important opportunity.
A quick word here to talk about SeaPower Energy Management, our sponsor. We ask a ton of questions on this podcast, and they usually revolve around money in some way. And the folks at SeaPower, they get a ton of questions, usually revolving around money. The most common at HQ, why did I get this check? And that usually comes from someone in accounting who is responsible for paying energy bills. They're not used to getting a check back. They're used to writing those checks. There's got to be a mistake, right? Well, no, there's no mistake because you're working with SeaPower. SeaPower, their customers don't write checks. SeaPower writes checks to them. SeaPower's mission is to help its customers monetize their existing energy resources through a whole range of programs: demand-side energy management solutions, demand response, energy efficiency, energy storage, and other on-site generation. So SeaPower does this across all U.S. open energy markets and basically takes the assets you have and helps you make money. And this is done across commercial industrial customers, educational institutions, government, and the healthcare sector. SeaPower has this strategy that mixes the perfect blend of engineering, analysis, market intelligence, and performance solutions, and it helps you save, earn, and operate more efficiently. You're happy, the environment is happy, and most importantly, your CFO is happy. Find out how you can save, earn, and reach your green energy goals at SeaPowerEnergyManagement.com. In keeping with this whole revolution thing, let's now turn our attention to the latest strategy shifts at the top global energy companies. Just today, and we're recording this on a Thursday afternoon, the Norwegian oil and gas producer Statoil changed its name. It is taking out the word oil to reflect the shift toward new energy solutions like offshore wind and carbon capture. The new name, Equinor. It released a pretty cool rebranding ad on Twitter, which we'll link to in the show notes there. The first 2 weeks of March have been super busy with this kind of activity. Germany's top utilities, E.ON and RWE, announced a business switcheroo in which RWE would take control of E.ON's large-scale renewable energy assets, and E.ON would take over RWE's retail operations. Meanwhile, global utility ENGIE continues its acquisition spree. It acquired the U.S.-based commercial solar developer SoCore, and it also bought a majority stake in ElectroPower Systems, a France-based global developer of microgrids. And finally, GTM held its blockchain summit last week, and we released a report from GTM Research on energy blockchain trends, and we found four pilots underway here in the U.S. among utilities and dozens more around the world. So let's climb back up to the top and talk about Statoil, or I guess I should say Equinor. I think that's how you pronounce it. Catherine, what is the company becoming as far as we can tell?
Yeah, I mean, they had to take the oil out of the name and change the actual name because Statoil wouldn't work with like static. They would need to do something completely different. So yeah, they're becoming Equinor, this clean energy company. And they've been doing this in reality over time. The issue is, you know, are you just changing your name? Are you changing your whole brand? Are you changing your mission and the way you're doing business and implementing it? You know, these are all the big questions about all of these things. And it looks like they're kind of doing everything. They're changing their name. They've changed how they've branded themselves so that they really are much more about clean energy. And it seems that they're executing on all of those things as well. So we'll see what happens. They are also in the U.S. as Empire doing offshore wind. And so it'll be interesting to see whether that also changes to Equinor.
Jigar, as soon as I tweeted this out, I got a question from someone on Twitter who said, is this just, you know, a fancy rebranding? We see this a lot. We saw it with BP when they labeled themselves Beyond Petroleum. Of course, that didn't work out so well. BP has made kind of another reversal on that, and they're getting back into renewables. So give us your assessment. Do you think this is just a PR exercise or something real?
I wish these guys would focus a lot less on their name and focus more on what they're doing. I had this long conversation about David Crane and NRG the other day with somebody, as well as like, you know, sort of Jim Rogers and Duke. Like when you think about these companies, you don't think of them as progressive in any way. Like right now, Duke Energy is trying to kill the solar industry in South Carolina. So like, I just think that at some point you're like with this name change, are they actually going to be supportive of all of the changes needed in the transportation system, as we just discussed with Dan Sperling, or the electricity system, as, you know, Varun and Shale talk about within wholesale markets, or, you know, like all of these like changes that are afoot, are they actually holding us back and saying that we should move more slowly and, you know, allow their businesses to change over time? Or are they actually pushing for accelerating the businesses faster?
I do agree that we should have skepticism. There, you know, this is a public relations move, clearly, but it does back up what the company has been trying to implement. We will have Stephen Bull, who is, forgive me for forgetting his exact title, but he's, you know, the head of New Energy Solutions, basically at Statoil, and he's working a lot on their CCS efforts around the world and their booming efforts in offshore wind. And he's super serious about this. He'll be on the show to talk about it. So I think listeners can gauge how serious a company like Statoil, or formerly known as Statoil, is in this area.
Yeah, I mean, not to belabor this point, but I just think that leadership matters, right? I mean, there's always somebody who runs a division who's super great at the job and really smart. But when you think about like what Lou Gerstner did at IBM, where he sold off all of the hardware units and turned them into a software company, right? That's something David Crane could not do at NRG, right? And so I just think that when you think about Bob Dudley at BP or some of these other leaders, most of them are physically incapable of bringing their shareholders around, bringing their senior leadership team around. Yeah, everyone can start up a division and put somebody progressive in that role, but actually changing the fundamental nature of the company has really never been done before. And so I just think that we should all, it's not about being skeptical, it's just about being realistic around, like, you know, the fact that everyone, almost without exception, has failed at this.
Yeah, but honestly, I think the CEOs of companies like Engie and Enel really are out there. They really are changing their companies, and that comes from the very top.
Right, but the question, Catherine, is that if you are a shareholder in Enel or in Engie, what exactly is it that you're investing in? What do you believe their growth prospects are? Like, is it coming out of their new energy division? Or is that just a way for them to like deal with regulatory uncertainty in the rest of their business that's generating all the cash?
Well, they're divesting and getting out of coal and building community centers and, you know, other new technologies in place of those plants. So I think they're pretty serious.
Yeah, maybe it'll be helpful to talk about Engie and Catherine. I'm so glad that you brought in the right pronunciation. I always say NG. But we'll talk about some of the moves that it made recently. Just one last point on Statoil. I am a big believer, based on my conversations with the company, that this is for real. However, when you look at their, you know, their projections going out, like, they're largely still going to rely on oil production for their revenues. So they want to drop their own carbon dioxide emissions by 20%. It's going to funnel a quarter of its research dollars into new energy solutions like efficiency, carbon capture, and offshore wind. But there's going to be a pretty significant focus on oil going forward. And there are a lot of people out there who say that in order to get on a climate stabilization path, you know, we need to keep a lot more in the ground. So there is an argument to be made that this is a public relations play more than a transition strategy. But of course, we all recognize how hard this is, and the fact that a company like Statoil is putting 25% of its R&D money into these solutions is also a significant milestone. So I think there's an argument to be made on both sides, and I hope that we'll be able to unpack that with Stephen Bull in a few weeks when he comes on the podcast. Now over to Engie, which, boy, it's been, you know, engaged in a lot of activity recently. Just in the last year, this company took a majority stake in the battery company Green Charge Networks. It acquired Optera, an energy services company. It acquired EVBox, the energy charging company. It invested in Advanced Microgrid Solutions, the distributed battery commercial battery company. It now bought the commercial assets of SoCor, and it invested in Electro Power Systems, which is building microgrids around the world. Wow, what a crazy set of activity. It's giving Enel a run for its money in acquisitions.
Yeah, but what they're both doing is they're going to the common denominator, which is the consumer. The consumer is always going to be there. You can build a widget and sell the widget, and it can be outdated in 10 years, and then you got to replace the widget with something different. But the consumer is always there. So what they're doing is they're coming up with what are all of the things that we can build and market that still are relevant with what we do and what we know how to do, but that really engage the consumer, whether it's energy management, whether it's using data and allowing consumers to have access to data. I think that that's what they're doing. They're doing the tools that consumers can use so that they can manage everything on the system.
Yeah. I think Enel and Engie are different, right? Enel is really one of the largest utility companies in the world. And as we discussed earlier, a lot of these acquisitions, frankly, never have to make any money. They can really just pay for them through the efficiency gains that they can make within their own company. Engie's different, right? So Engie has sold all of their coal and natural gas assets in the United States and, you know, put that money on their balance sheet. Now they've done a lot of these acquisitions, but Engie still has $66 billion a year in revenue, right? And $10 billion a year in profit. And so when you look at how much of that actually comes from what you would consider new energy and how much of the profit comes from new energy is pretty much zero. And so then the question really becomes like, you know, if I'm a shareholder of Engie, am I holding the stock because I believe this new energy vision is going to bear fruit? Or am I banking on the fact that the $66 billion of existing revenue and $10 billion of existing profits that they're making are going to keep happening for the next 20 years?
I'm headed in a few weeks to the Berlin Energy Transition Dialogue meeting, which is going to deal with the Energiewende. I don't know how you say it. Energiewende in Germany. And hopefully I'll hear from a lot of these folks. I know Energy will be there, RWE, probably Engie and Enel will be there too. And it will be very interesting to see what their position is in the EU compared to what they're doing right now in the US.
It's really interesting to think about where we've come since the clean tech bubble burst in the, 2011 timeframe. 2012 timeframe, utilities are the new venture investors. It's clear that the if you're a startup, it's very probably common for you to think about your exit strategy as getting acquired by a utility now. And this activity is not going to slow down. I think we expect deal flow to increase over 2017. So just kind of interesting in the historical context of how investment trends have evolved over time in the venture sector. Well, normally at this point in the show, we tell you something you may not know, and I just thought it was time for a little bit of a rebrand, give us more of an energy theme. So we're calling this last segment Free Electron. We're going to give you a free electron. That's the same thing. It's a news nugget. It's something that's happening in our business lives, a story that we're following, a conversation that we've had, and hopefully those free electrons can go and help you explore new topics and maybe help you out in your job. So, Jigar, we haven't heard from you in weeks. What's your free electron?
Well, I will call it the news story that's too cheap to meter. No. But Tesla continues to struggle. And so yesterday was one of the toughest days in the last little while for Tesla, where, Susan Repo left. She was the company's corporate treasurer and VP of finance. And, this just came a week after the company's chief accounting officer left. And, there's a lot of reporting from CNBC and others that, that an estimate of 40% of the parts made or received at Fremont needed rework. So, it does feel like, unfortunately, my prediction of Tesla not really being a manufacturing company is coming true.
Mm-hmm. And this is the make or break moment. This is the exact moment that we've talked about over the last 2 years, which is Tesla wants to become a car company. Now they've got to scale up in every area of their business. They can't have too many technical failures because they can be cascading and could hinder their ability to deliver the amount of cars they want to deliver. And so these troubles are not looking good for Tesla. Interestingly, you know, SolarCity is getting increasingly marginalized within the company too. But that's, you know, that's a whole different story. Catherine, what's your free electron?
Right. So this is a story I think we've mentioned before, which is in Arizona, the commission and specifically Commissioner Andy Tobin has been really pushing on getting to 80% clean energy in 2050 and 3 gigawatts of storage by 2030. Well, the commission just denied the utility the 15-year integrated resource plan and said, you guys need to go back. And you need to do more renewables, and we're going to put a moratorium on natural gas over 150 megawatts. So they're definitely trying to go to free electrons and not have them build additional gas that they really don't need out there.
So GTM's new Solar Market Insight report is out, which we put together with the Solar Energy Industries Association. And for the first time since we've been tracking this sector, we saw a decline in installations in the U.S. So we saw 10.6 gigawatts of PV installed in 2017, and that's down from 15 gigawatts in 2016. There are a lot of reasons for that. Top residential markets are slowing down. One of the top installers, SolarCity, now Tesla, is de-emphasizing solar and emphasizing batteries. And so we've just seen a crazy drop in the amount of activity that SolarCity was formerly engaged in. Obviously, the boom in 2016 was due to the rush to capture tax credits, and we saw a lot of utility-scale solar developed as a result. So the decline in utility-scale solar was expected. But you know, I think a couple years ago, we didn't necessarily expect this serious decline in residential installations. And, you know, it's just that the top markets have slowed down a bit. So there's a lot of rationalization happening in the solar market right now. We do expect continued growth, but it's a down period right now. That's the end of the show, folks. So glad to have you back, Jigar.
It's good to be back. I missed you guys.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're back, Jigar, only because I was needing to get just a little bit annoyed every week. So thank you.
You got to have it. You got to have it. The weekly diet of Jigar. You know, Jigar, speaking of that, you're going to get an even bigger dose of Jigar because he was on the What It Takes series, our live interview series that the folks at Powerhouse, Emily Kirsch, the CEO of Powerhouse, records with top executives in the industry to hear about their journeys as entrepreneurs, how they formed their companies, the issues and BS that they've dealt with in their careers, how they've persevered. And it sounded like, I was not there, unfortunately, but it sounded like it was a really great conversation. So we're going to feature that next week. Jigar, anything we should be listening for?
Stay tuned. A lot of great tidbits got out there. She's a great interviewer.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And you get a sense of the personal stories of a lot of these folks. You know, we tend to focus a lot on the business trends, and Emily starts off with a more personal touch and gets the background, the narrative of the person who's getting interviewed. So I enjoy that. Anyway, stay tuned for that. Catherine and Jigar, thanks again. For you all out there, if you like these conversations, please give us a rating review on Apple Podcasts. Many of you have done so. We appreciate it so much. Thank you. Listen to our other interview podcast, The Interchange. I co-host that with Shale Khan. This week, we have a set of interviews with Google and Microsoft talking about the evolution of the deals they're signing for renewables, their outlook for storage, and how they're changing their procurements. Like, they're more closely matching supply with their localized demand. And this is a very new thing, and they're just getting a feel for how it might work. So, you know, tune into The Interchange for that. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I'm Stephen Lacey. This is The Energy Gang from Green Tech Media. We'll catch you next time.